Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Brooke Gladstone is a Peabody Award-winning journalist and co-host of On the Media. Her new book is called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. It's an extended conversation about living in our personal bubbles, how stereotypes impact our worldview, and how a consensus regarding reality was perhaps always more vulnerable than we thought. Brooke Gladstone joins us now. Brooke, welcome.
Thank you. Good summary.
Thank you very much. You have said elsewhere that this is somewhat of a personal book. Is reality always personal by definition?
Absolutely. I mean, we are all separate people in this world, and we have our skins separating us from the rest of the world, and we have our senses, believe it or not, separating us as much as it unites us with the rest of the world. We can't take in the world in all its complexity. It would paralyze us. We have to create a narrative, a story, a system that is consistent and relatively predictable in order to function at all. So we are filtering beings, and that has always been the case. It's just that technology has made it easier. That's pretty much it.
And then where does the stereotype come into play? Is it always a negative connotation, that word stereotype?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The first person to use it as the way we use it now was a newspaper man named Walter Lippmann. He was also a critic in the 20s. And he said, basically, stereotypes are... they're shortcuts. They're heuristics, one might say. They are another way that we try to simplify the world. So we will take one salient feature of a person, say, you know, they're from Brooklyn, or they're from Baton Rouge, or they're black, or they're white, or they're an international banker, or they're a kindergarten teacher. And knowing that much, we fill in the rest of the blanks, and we think we know them enough. We also have stereotyped ideas. The notion that was very much at play when Lippmann wrote the book Public Opinion was that technology was always good, that technology would enable people to be richer and freer, and the cost would be minimal. You know, it was simple. It was a way to make policy, and we applied it, that very notion, you know, with abandon in our world then, and have, you know, lived to reap the consequences. Mm-hmm. So stereotypes, ideas, and people designed to create a consistent universe that we can live in relatively at peace. It may not be the universe that we want. It may not be the one that we seek or we strive for. It is simply one that makes sense. And the reason why I wrote this book is because, at least in my little East Coast bubble, and I think probably in most cities, in every state in the country, you know, there are people who are anxious in a way that they have never been before. I mean, we've all had elections that haven't gone the way that we wanted, presidents we didn't want, fears about the future of the country. We've all had that. This anxiety, this stress seemed to go beyond politics or a president down to the very nation of the world, that the very heart of the world that we were living in and the nation we were living in, and suddenly doubting whether or not what we believed to be true was in fact true.
Why this president versus liberal concerns about George W. Bush or another president? What is it about the campaign and the victory of Donald Trump and the administration of Donald Trump that really shatters that particular reality and resonates for as long as it has, past the 100-day mark and beyond?
Yep. Now... you brought up George Bush, which, you know, who was a nightmare president for many liberals and Democrats. What's the difference here? There's a huge difference, because even though George Bush's administration, notably Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and others, Rumsfeld too, essentially lied in the run-up to the Iraq War, It was a consistent lie. Does that seem like, well, what's the difference? Here's the difference. As Karl Rove, it was later revealed to be Karl Rove, told the New York Times' Ron Suskind in an article in the New York Times Magazine, you are the reality-based community, so get ready. We are the reality crafters, and we will send them at you, and you're just going to have to deal with them in endless succession, whether you like it or not. In other words, he was saying that the narrative crafting was more important than the facts that the New York Times reporters were so busy and engaged in trying to check and so on. It was a story. But the difference is that the Bush administration's story in the run-up to the war in Iraq was consistent, and it was for a purpose. The difference is that Trump is calling into question the very value, the very idea of reality itself. Mm-hmm. Basically, he's saying, it doesn't matter if you catch me in a lie. Lies don't matter. In fact, as I quote Masha Gessen in the book, saying, the lying is the point. I can basically assume dominion over truth. And you can believe me today, and then if I say something different tomorrow, you can believe me tomorrow, or you can simply wink along with me that you're in on the joke. I'm on your side. I'll give you what you want. And what I say and what I assert from day to day doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. It devalues facts, big and small. He puts them all in the same basket and says, essentially, facts don't matter. He said, don't believe, the polls that say I'm doing badly, fake news. Don't believe the Congressional Budget Office. Don't believe the consensus of opinion on global warming. Don't believe what I said 2 weeks ago or 2 days ago or this morning. It doesn't matter. The truth itself is a liar.
I'm curious, as you mentioned Karl Rove and Dick Cheney, about the people that President Trump surrounds himself, specifically McMaster and Kelly and Mattis. You hear these names as sort of the buffer to that, the grown-ups in the room. So interesting that, we're seeing H.R. McMaster today talk about, things that recently happened with the exchange between the president and delegates from Russia. And people are saying, if McMaster says it, it's good enough for me. What does it mean to surround the president like Trump and the way he ran his campaign with people like H.R. McMaster?
Well, obviously, McMaster, McMaster was not his first choice. McMaster is a soldier. He's still a soldier. He will serve his commander in chief. He does have a reputation for absolute integrity and probity, no question. But you have to consider the way his words were parsed. And yeah, this was gone over like some sort of, ancient runic text by the New York Times and the Washington Post, to see exactly what he was saying. And, he said that sources and practices were not revealed, absolutely not revealed. What he didn't say, which is what the Post actually said, was that that Trump had revealed enough information that sources could be ascertained circumstantially, and in fact they were pretty obvious. So McMaster's was answering a question or essentially responding to a charge that was never made by the newspapers. The charge was he revealed enough information to let the Russians know things that he wouldn't have even shared with the U.S. Congress, or wouldn't believe himself to have been able to, because it was code word information. He didn't explicitly release sources and practices, or procedures, and that was what H.R. McMaster was responding to. So it's this kind of parsing that I think McMaster hopes will enable him to hold on to his integrity and not find it subsumed and swept away in the tidal wave of mendacity that seems to characterize the Trump administration.
My guest, if you're just tuning in, this is In the Moment. My guest, Brooke Gladstone. She's co-host of On the Media. We're talking about her new book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. And Brooke, this comparison between Brave New World, Aldous Huxley, and 1984, George Orwell is particularly fascinating. Can you lay that out for me and,
sure.
and show how these two authors sort of... addressed the idea of the future in different ways.
Yeah, I really admired what Neil Postman did here. He basically said, you are what you eat. And he wrote this book in 1985 called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And in it, it was essentially a really impassioned warning label on our media diet. And to illustrate the danger, he contrasts these two pivotal works of dystopian fiction, George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And he says that in Orwell's vision, we're crushed by a merciless oppression imposed by others, whereas in Huxley's vision, we are seduced, sedated, and we enslave ourselves. What he said was, Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture. Orwell observed in 1984 that people were controlled by inflicting pain. But in Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us.
You found, Neil Postman, Jonathan Swift, Alex, Huxley, so many different references to sort of, fill in the blanks. Did you find some solace, some fear or sort of discomfort in finding some of the things that people have written in the past that apply to now as you see it?
Aren't you more comfortable when facing panic, when you realize that people have been here before and yet the Republic survived? I always find, maybe this is just me, but I'm sure it must be other people, that if you place yourself in a broader perspective, if you take a few steps back, you can see yourself in a continuum, and then maybe you can see your role a little bit better. And if you have a role, if you can take part rather than just be a passive bit of, flotsam on the wave of history, then I think there's a consolation in that. No, it's not a kind of, it's going to be all right, sweetie, it's going to be all right. There's a lot of work to do. And even worse, a lot of the work is internal, because we didn't see it coming because we didn't want to see it coming. I am urging people in the end of the book to simply try and see over the barriers of your own bubble. I'm not saying hands across the sea. Compromise with people who don't share your values, who don't see the world the same way. I don't say that at all. Our values are what make us who we are. I'm simply saying see them. If you don't see that other reality, then you aren't going to prevent further collisions from smashing yours up, and you won't be able to rebuild it in a way that's a little more durable. I'm simply saying, make an effort to see. That's hard enough, but we can do it.
We're talking with Brooke Gladstone right now. Her book is called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. This is obviously South Dakota public broadcasting. You're talking to listeners in a state that largely voted for Donald Trump in the election. Mm-hmm. And how does that, we're in a different bubble than you are in, and maybe many here were not surprised. to
right.
see President Trump defeat Hillary Clinton in the election.
Absolutely.
And we're not necessarily thrown into a panic over it either, although some certainly are. What is the way that a largely rural state looks out of its own bubble to see sort of what's happening in some of the places like New York to say, you know, what do we need to consider next going forward, whether or not you care for this president, his behavior, his words, or his policies?
I want to be really clear about this, and I'm really glad I get to talk to South Dakota, because, the Trump voters did see it coming. There was, yes, Hillary won the popular vote, but it was a close vote. And there was a much greater constituency there for change than the liberal establishment realized. The liberal establishment felt that they could continue going on like the Republican establishment every 4 years, make promises, and then not show up again. And I think that probably many of your listeners would say that voting for Trump was as much a repudiation as the Republican establishment as it was the liberal one. There were plenty of people who crossed over from Bernie to Trump, and there were plenty of people who crossed over from Bernie to nothing. All, you know, the other establishment Republican candidates were knocked over like a bunch of bowling pins. So this was a protest against the system that the complacent liberals like myself in our bubbles thought would always endure. To many people, this was just smash it. Let's try something new. And once you've sort of committed yourself to, letting the old system fall apart, then all kinds of other norms can be broken as well. I mean, I think that there is already a certain concern that, perhaps smashing it isn't going to leave people better off than they were before. But the need for a change clearly was paramount in the minds of many people, and they were willing to take the risk because they felt their world already at risk.
Right.
They already felt that what they believed about the nation was getting smashed and hammered by the reality they saw around them. What? I do address this in the book. I'm very honest and transparent about this being from a liberal perspective. I talk about the historical precedence to the way Trump used the media in a way that harkens back to earlier eras. But I am speaking as someone who is responding to those who are utterly horrified. But the general principles of this very little book, and let's face it, it's really more of an extended essay than it is a book, is the same whether no matter what political persuasion you are or where you stand on the spectrum, the fact is that we, none of us, see clearly. And all of us have to see better if we want democracy to work. Because if anything the liberals have found out is that democracy is a system, it's a process. It does not exist in a vacuum. It is entirely dependent on the people who pull the levers and who populate the structure. And it doesn't work if the people don't share in a common goal.
Here's one of the things that I hear from South Dakotans who did support Trump, even those who supported him with reservations. And during that first 100 days, I heard a lot of, well, what's wrong with slowing things down? What's wrong with an immigration ban as we try to fit? There was a sense that things are moving. On one hand, nothing's getting done in Congress, and there's a frustration there. And then on the other hand, there was the sense that I kept hearing again and again that everything is moving too fast. listen to us. We have things to say too. We have questions. Why can't we just pause? Do you hear that in an urban center, an East Coast coastal enclave there? Because that's what's coming, bouncing around in my bubble here a lot of the time. When some people had concerns about immigration reform, other people said, no, it's time that we slow down. And they always use that word, slow down. Let's talk about it.
What is it that they want to slow down? I'm not sure. Is it that they want to slow down what everyone is trying to do, or what liberals are trying to do, or what Trump is trying to do? I'm a little confused.
Yeah, and I don't know if I can answer that. There was just an overall sense that certain things are moving too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And give us a little bit of time to, have our voices heard too. And, a sense of throwing up your arms in that sense. And I'm wondering if that does not make sense to you, or if you can sort of see that perspective as well.
It makes sense. It makes sense. I think there wasn't a huge amount to change. I mean, Obama's signature accomplishment was probably, the Affordable Health Care Act. Beyond that, things haven't changed much, not even under Trump. Have they changed much yet? It's the norms that are broken, conflict of interest and that sort of thing. But in terms of policy, it's actually too soon. I think that there is a sense, and, I could be corrected on this, that there are ways that the country is changing that people just aren't prepared for. Mm. But it's like the weather. You can't stop it. It's just happening. And if you want to live in the world, to some degree, you have to adapt to it. Slowing down policy, giving everybody a chance to have a voice, of course. And that is how democracy is supposed to work. Presumably, they have the same voice as any other non-millionaire or billionaire in the U.S., because we all know there's a double standard for influence. But whether you live in Detroit or whether you live in Vermilion, you have the same opportunity to call your congressman. And by the way, calling congresspeople is much more effective than signing on to an email, or showing up at their offices, or making a small contribution, or writing a letter, or running for office yourself. It's a tough road that every citizen has to hoe who doesn't have much money. And there are plenty, mostly, people who don't have much money in many of the places that voted Democratic. So those voices, the mechanisms are there. They don't work very well. If you want your voices heard, it's always been the same thing. There hasn't been a big onrush of policy. But the country is changing. And I wonder, when people talk about, hold on a moment there, they're talking about the country, which is going to change demographically, its industrial base is going to change, all of that is going to change, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. There's nothing Washington can do to stop it. They're not going to bring back coal jobs. Hardly anybody, more people work for Walmart, many more people work for Walmart than work in the coal industry. It's just going away. The demographics are changing. We have to get new skills. We have to figure out in communities how to get them to work on a different basis. The old world, you can't stand in the same river twice. History moves on. The place we grew up in isn't the place your children's children will grow up in, and you can't make it be that. So that fundamental acceptance, all of us across the spectrum have to get down with.
Let's finish up with a wake-up call for the media. You say that this could be the point out that some people are saying this could be a golden age of journalism. How come?
Well, we know that newspaper business models got busted by the internet because they posted stuff online and people started thinking that they wouldn't have to pay for information anymore. In fact, they misappropriated the sentence, "information wants to be free," to mean, information needs to not cost anything, when really what it meant was unfettered, right? Mm. So so they've been struggling. Local newspaper bureaus have gone away. Subscribers went away. Local papers and local communities fallen on hard times all across the country, especially in, you know, in the West and the Midwest, where there just aren't a lot of people to support them, and yet no one else is doing that reporting. Well, at least in the, at least in some places, people realize that they will have to pay for information that they can trust from people who's, you know, who they regard as generally reliable, even though all reporters make mistakes. And so the New York Times is doing much better. So is the Washington Post. Public radio is finding that people who have relied on that information are more willing to support it because they realize that reality itself is at risk. The big problem, of course, the big challenge is, first of all, how to say the truth fairly and accurately without being so concerned with a kind of numerical balance, you know, two unequal issues getting equal time. So you have to use some judgment, but you have to be fair. You have to be accurate. But that doesn't mean that you gratuitously insult or leap from your fact-based judgments into unsupported assertions and assumptions. I mean, it's a new tightrope. It's less safe than it used to be. Reporters used to retreat into neutral language because everyone was playing by the same rules. The government of Donald J. Trump is playing by different rules. It isn't even strategic lying. It's the point of the lie that what the wheels of accountability do, whether it's the media or the Congressional Budget Office or the data collected by the EPA, all of those, as far as Donald Trump, says, asserts and tweets and over again, none of this matters. Basically, we all are special interests. We have an agenda. You don't need to believe us. You don't need to take us seriously. So on the one hand, the media are benefiting from a more engaged populace. On the other hand, the media's trust, especially among Republicans, is historically low. In fact, the only institution that is trusted less is the Congress.
Brooke Gladstone is the co-host of WNYC's On the Media. Her new book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. Brooke, thank you so much for spending time with us today in South Dakota.
Thank you, Laurie.